Hey there, conductors. If you've ever felt that you're not quite sure what to do next when you're studying a score, maybe you don't even know where to start with a difficult piece, maybe you study one piece too much and then you realize at the first rehearsal that you don't know another one well enough, or maybe you're a new conductor and you don't know what score study is, I'm excited to share that I'm finally publishing and sharing my score study checklist. I've been refining this for 12 years now, and I'm so excited to share it. It is going to walk you through my structure, my process to make sure that I learn every score that I need to learn well enough and so that nothing falls through the cracks. So it covers everything that you need to know. There's a link in the show notes. Go ahead and click it, sign up, and you'll get that score study checklist sent right to your email. You'll also get access to an 8-minute video of me explaining what each section is and how I use it to organize all the music that I need to learn. It's only 8 minutes, so it's not going to take you a whole hour to learn how to study better, how to put up a process for your score study, and how to make sure that nothing is falling through the cracks. So again, click the link in the show notes, and I hope to see you soon. Now, please enjoy this episode of Podium Time. Welcome to Podium Time, the podcast for conductors and students.
It's so interesting how musicians can innately sense where it is you're listening. Even if you're not looking directly there, the way that we connect to the ensemble either helps to focus their listening in a good way, or it doesn't. And it either connects us to the group or it doesn't. I do believe that the more we move, generally speaking, the less we hear. So one of the ways that I train conductors or teach conducting or talk about how to better facilitate our groups playing together is just to not conduct.
Hello and welcome to Podium Time. So happy to have you here this week and every week. I'm your host, Jeremy DeQuibus, and today Luke and I are excited to share this long-awaited interview with Gary Lewis. Now, most of you probably know Gary from his Orchestral Conducting Symposium, or as the Director of Orchestras at the University of Colorado Boulder, where that symposium takes place. And actually, that's where we met him at that symposium a couple years ago. And if you've been listening for a while, or if you've ever taken a deep dive into the archives of the podcast, you'll remember that Gary was a guest all the way back on episode two, the second episode back in 2017 of the podcast when we launched in a mini episode with Larry Livingston, and that was right after Luke and I did his workshop. But now we've got him here for a full episode, and it was well worth the wait. So today we're talking with Gary about why orchestra should work like chamber music, how we all need to listen, and we really dive into how we as conductors can enable and allow our orchestras to play the best they can by not getting in the way, by only doing what we need to do. There's a lot of great stuff in here. We talk about listening, we talk about learning to listen and teaching orchestras to listen, teaching conductors to listen. It's a whole thing. We've never talked about listening on the podcast so much as we do today. So if you're a conductor, you should definitely listen to this one. As always, I'd also like to extend a huge thank you to our supporters on Patreon who help keep the lights on here at Podium Time by supporting us with just a few bucks a month. The previous episode in our feed, PT89, was a review/summary of Markand Thacker's Make Beautiful Music class, and that's the kind of thing our assistant conductors get on Patreon. They get reviews, score analyses, we'll have some coming up, and extra discussions with me and Luke, and it's really just a way to offer a little bit more to those that choose to support the podcast. You can also become a donor, or you can join for just $1 a month to get early access to our interviews and get our PT recaps. So basically, anytime we finish recording an episode, we will we'll do a little recap of what we talked about with the guest, and we'll put that on the Patreon feed. So, like this interview we learned about in April. So our patrons have known about what we talked about today since April, even though now it is August. Sorry, it's September. Oh my God, what a year. What a year 2020 has been. So head over to patreon.com/podiumtimepod to check out that community and see if supporting the podcast is right for you. You can also support just by following and sharing our episodes on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. You know, just share it with your friends. Tell your friends you're listening to Podium Time and how awesome it is. And don't forget to join our Facebook group, the Podium Time Inner Circle. There you can connect with other listeners, suggest new interview guests, and be the first to take part in new updates to the podcast. Sometimes we send out a little poll. We run experiments on there a little bit. So links for everything are in the show notes below. I'm going to stop rambling now. I've had a great time, and I hope you have a great time listening to this episode with Gary Lewis. Well, Maestro Gary Lewis, thanks so much for joining us today.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Would you give our listeners a brief overview of who you are and what you do?
My academic home is at the University of Colorado Boulder. I'm the director of orchestral studies there. This is ending my 12th year on the faculty at CU Boulder. I'm also fortunate to be the music director and conductor of the Midland Odessa Texas Symphony Orchestra. And I also am the conductor of the Symphony Orchestra and the Greater Boulder Youth Orchestra system. So kind of have a foot in each of those worlds at this point. I'm really grateful.
Yeah. And where did you know, we've known each other for a couple of years now, but I don't know anything about your study history, where you were before Boulder. Could you just overview that as well?
Sure. I mean, my route to the orchestral podium is pretty circuitous and pretty unusual, I think. I was a undergraduate music education major looking to be the best high school band director I could possibly be. I opted at the end of my undergrad to go directly into graduate school, and so I was a wind conducting major as a master's student. I was still networking, still looking to be a high school band director, and then one of my colleagues who had graduated a year before me had moved to Abilene, Texas, and was teaching in the three small colleges there. And he connected me with John Whitwell, who was then the director of bands at Abilene Christian University, retired as director of bands from Michigan State University. And he was looking to get out from under the Low Brass Studio, which was the last thing I ever expected to do. But I drove down there once a week, taught low brass, and that turned into a full-time job. I became his associate and essentially walked into a college-level band job and remained there for 3 years. And John Whitwell had kind of connected me to the Michigan world, Carl St. Clair and Larry Ratcliffe and Bob Reynolds and those folks, because he had taught in Michigan. So I attended several workshops during those years and got to know Bob Reynolds, got to know my work. And so I invited me to apply and I became his associate. So I was on the faculty at Michigan for a few years as principally as a band conductor, but Gustav Meyer was the director of orchestras at that point. And so I just adopted him as a mentor, went to his classes, took video to him, grew more in those years than I think I ever had. Went to the Tanglewood Seminar as an auditor a couple of summers. Gustav was still running that Pierre Montu School, and then decided I needed to get out from under some of the responsibilities I had there, so became director of bands at Ohio State University for 3 years, of all places to go from Michigan, right? Mm-hmm. And then the orchestra position, I was continuing to conduct orchestras in the summers and at different festivals and such. And so my original mentor at Texas Tech, where I did my master's degree, was interested in bringing me back to lead the orchestra program. So I was really fortunate to get that job, which also involved a really active and high-quality opera program. So for 10 years, I conducted opera and orchestra at Texas Tech, and during those years became associated with the Midland Odessa Symphony as their music director, and which I continue to do to this day. And now, as I mentioned, I'm finishing my 12th year on the faculty at CU Boulder.
The Midland Odessa, what level group is that?
It's a tier, I can't remember what the tier is. It's well over $1 million budget, annual budget, and a really fine orchestra. We have about a six-year-old performing arts center, which is just beautiful, world-class acoustics, and I'm so proud of that orchestra and what they do, and I'm so proud to be associated with them.
Yeah. So it's like one concert a month. About.
Basically one cycle a month plus a Nutcracker plus ballet, that sort of stuff.
Yeah. And how closely did you work with Gustav Meyer?
Well, I was his colleague, but I just, like I said, I just adopted him as a mentor. I mean, I literally went to his classes, to a seminar class.
Oh, okay.
I took video to him. Talked to him. He gave me most importantly, he gave me opportunities to conduct the orchestra at least once a year. So that was really important for my growth. And like I mentioned, I I attended the Tanglewood for a couple of weeks, a couple of summers as an auditor in the program there, which he was leading. And so he just meant everything to me as far as conducting is concerned and learning how to get better at this art.
What are some of the sayings or, you know, lasting lessons that he or any other teachers had?
Well, his whole overarching philosophy was to, I think, I'm not sure he ever stated it in these terms, but was to facilitate the orchestra to play better together. Mm-hmm. And so the way you move, the way you listen, all that either contributes to that and facilitates the orchestra to play better together, or it makes it more difficult for them. So the economy of movement, the from posture to attitude, body attitude, the strength and veracity of the beat, all those things. Veracity is not the right word. You can edit that out. But, strength of the beat, all that. It was really informative. I remember he used to say often, "Death to the beat," which has stuck with me, And he always, his ideas about upbeats and breathing and not stopping the motion, not mm-hmm. stopping the beat, all those things have been just life changers for me.
Yeah. How are some of the ways that you can facilitate that orchestra playing?
First of all, by not dictating when they play. So it's a matter of trusting them. And that's something that I've become more and more evangelistic about. I think at the essence of conducting is trust. And if we trust the ensemble to do the things that they can do, then that frees us up to do other things. Another one of my fabulous colleagues at Michigan was Bob Reynolds, and who was director of bands. And he had a saying, "Try to do only the things that only you can do." Now, he was talking about administrative things, I think, a lot. So trying to delegate, administrative duties, which are part of all of our jobs. But I think it's equally applicable to when we're on the podium to try to do only the things that only we can do, which is to provide an overarching interpretation, to be able to hear the group globally and with some sense of accuracy and balance. And then we yield to the musicians to play to exactly when does that sound start. And for the ongoing pulse. And if we can figure out how to not step on their toes and free them to do that, I think it really enhances the way they play. I'm always grateful when somebody says something like, "Hey, you really let them play," or "I noticed how you let them play." Mm-hmm. And I don't think that's an indictment of a lack of musical leadership. I think it's an appreciation for the fact that it's up to the group, and creating a chamber music setting for them to interact. That's the way great orchestras play well together. That's the way chamber ensembles do in the absence of the conductor. So those are some of the things that were at the center of, I think, his philosophy and his philosophy of teaching conducting.
Yeah. And do you take that in still, and how do you apply it differently to your professional versus your educational orchestras?
Absolutely. I mean, I think we have to train our educational orchestras to do that, but I think it's a worthy goal. They're not going to do it the first time. Youth orchestra's not going to play together, or our middle school orchestra's not going to play together. We can't just say, "Okay, go get them," and expect it to be great. We have to teach them how to play together. We have to teach them how to feel the internal pulse. We have to teach them how to listen to the pulse when it's in the cellos and basses, or if it's in the timpani or snare drum. So it's a matter of directing their listening and equipping them with the skills to succeed. I mean, our whole duty as educators is to make ourselves obsolete, to equip our students with the skills that they need to transcend what it is we're doing with them and to go on to become better musicians. And so the more we hover over them with this beat, all the time, the more we're actually stifling their ability to grow.
Yeah. And how do you teach that to the groups besides just awareness of what to listen to?
Well, I think it is awareness mostly. I teach them, you know, and I think it's important for us to think about as conductors that we hear with our eyes. Mm-hmm. And so it's not a matter of that. By that, I don't mean that the group needs to watch us with more intently. In fact, that's a phrase that I try not to ever utter, which is watch me, you know. But if we give them a reason to watch us, you know, and we've equipped them with the skills to breathe together and to watch each other, that's the beauty of string playing particularly, is that it's the technique, the rhythm, the articulation, everything is right out there in front of us for to see. I'll never forget Catherine Comey, one of my heroes, coming to the University of Michigan to do a workshop with some of the grad orchestral students at the time. And I learned that lesson from her very vividly. You know, you have to watch the string players.
Yeah.
There's so much that we can learn, and on such a more intimate level, we can connect with them musically. But that goes for them too. So I'm constantly talking about listening back and looking forward.
Yeah.
You know, cheating toward the oboist so that you, even if you can't literally see the oboist, you're listening to them with your eyes as much as you can.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So an awareness of the score, a knowledge of the score, awareness of how their part fits in with the whole, being, you know, out of the stand. Of course, all this implies greater mastery of the technique, right? Because the more bound we are to by the technique, the more we're going to be in the stand and the less aware we're going to be. That's certainly true of conductors, and that could lead us off into a discussion of score study and preparation. But I think the main reason for us to be prepared is so that we can hear better.
Yeah.
And so I remember as a young musician, I played a lot of jazz. I was a jazz guitarist, and I remember going to hear the Count Basie Orchestra and just being amazed. I had no idea what it was that I was seeing, but in retrospect, those musicians were so aware of him that all he had to do was just raise an eyebrow and boom, you know, this amazing impact would be there. And jazz musicians, the way they interact, and chamber musicians, the way they interact. So, so we talk about different people leading. We talk about how to breathe with each other, where to watch, who to connect with, and those types of things, I think, help direct their listening.
Yeah, yeah. And I remember from the workshop a couple of years ago, you had the score up on a screen above the orchestra.
Right.
Do I remember right that you do that for
Absolutely.
Rehearsals as well?
In every rehearsal possible.
Yeah.
Because not only can I quickly refer to it and make a point or point out something in the score, but it's there. I mean, I look up and I see especially the wind percussion players looking at it constantly.
Yeah.
It's just the greatest teaching tool that I've ever known of.
Mm-hmm. And again, that comes back to just awareness of what else is going on and what to listen to. And
exactly.
You know. Mm-hmm.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. You know, listening, and it brings to the point of listening with specificity. You know, in Gunther Schuller's book, The Complete Conductor, he talks about the seven different kinds of hearing, and he talks about how the ears are useless equipment unless they know what it is they should be listening for.
Yeah.
And so, especially with young conductors, just the sheer volume and mass of sound from an orchestra can be overwhelming. It's hard to really pinpoint anything in there, you know, that you can address or even hear with clarity. And so knowing what to listen for, both from your study of the score and your recollection from previous rehearsals and all those things, that can help us to really zoom in on specific issues within the orchestra. I heard one of my doctoral students the other day was giving a presentation, and she referred to it as the cocktail party effect. You know, when you walk into a cocktail party and you might be talking with other people, but if somebody on the other side of the room mentions your name, you can hear it like a, you know, with incredible clarity.
Mm-hmm.
And so we know to listen for our name because somebody might be talking about us. And it's that kind of hyper-awareness, you know, that I think can help guide us through the mass of sound in the orchestra and help us to listen with more specificity.
Well, with the cocktail party also, if you're in a room of people, you know, it's just the massive sound. Mm-hmm. But if you're watching somebody, you can start to pick out their sound out of everything. You know, I think
exactly.
Partly because of the mouth, and that just goes back to the visual communication in the orchestra.
Of course, that's our immediate response when we hear our name is to turn and look, you know. So
yeah, exactly.
So as a you know, a conductor who might just be starting their master's, or even somebody who, an undergraduate student who might be taking that first conducting class, you know, there's so much emphasis put on patterns, so much emphasis put on cueing, bringing the orchestra in together, you know, all of those aspects of control that really are brought to the forefront in most education, you know, educational conducting settings. So what would be like the first thing you would do to suggest to a student who might want to start focusing more on that chamber aspect? Like, what's the first thing that they might want to start thinking about focusing on while they're conducting or while they're preparing to kind of facilitate that learning?
You know, it's a great question. I think listening is the hardest aspect of conducting to teach, you know, and to learn, and just requires, you know, a great deal of experience. I've noticed almost, I was looking even the other day at just some of the conducting texts that I had in my library, and almost none of them address listening. You know, it's almost, or at least they do, it's a very, very small ratio of the information. It's mostly about, as you mentioned, patterns and cueing and all the mechanical aspects of conducting. And, you know, we have to have that vocabulary. We have to be able to communicate clearly in that sort of traffic cop kind of way. Back in the day when I taught undergraduate conducting, I even experimented with just not teaching anything like that at all and just having them moving to music, you know, organically. I've often said that if you stop, you know, Joe Schmo on the street and ask him to conduct, you know, something, you're probably more effective and more expressive than what a lot of us as, you know, young conductors do, just because they don't know the rules, you know.
Right.
So I think it's a matter of learning those rules and gaining that vocabulary, but as soon as possible, getting away from it, you know. It's almost like score study. You start with this macro idea, and then you zoom in on the micro, and then you go back to the macro with conducting. You start with the micro, you know, and then you're trying to get away as quickly as you can. So I'm not sure I have any special tricks other than just continuing to reinforce. So what did you hear? What was wrong? And then start, even through the instruction about score study, talking about things like color and line and architecture and things that transcend the beat, you know. And if we start thinking in those terms, about nuance and shape and direction, that I think it, and then how can our gesture support that? So rather than screaming at the group with our beat and with our cues, we're showing the music in a way that's more organic and more connected. I would just try to get to that as quickly as possible.
What's something you've changed your mind about recently?
You know, I contemplated that question a lot. I'm not sure there's anything I've really changed my mind about, other than just that listening is the most important thing that we do. Mm-hmm. I will say that I have kind of a new and refreshed perspective on silence in music. Mm-hmm. I remember at one of my early music director auditions, I was consulting with one of the musicians in the group, and his advice to me was just, and I was very young at the time, and he said, you just embrace the silence, be generous in those moments, because we hate silence. We're afraid of silence as musicians, and especially as conductors. So often it's rushed or not as generous as it should be. And then I renewed my attention on how we approach silence. And even if I'm not talking about grand pause, even, I'm talking about just a rest. How do we treat the end of the phrase? What kind of resonance are we thinking? I sometimes refer to, you need to add some resonance in a bag, you know, or some way to create resonance at the ends of these phrases, because so often, especially younger musicians, I think, tend to just play at the last note of a phrase instead of sending it into the silence. And of course, that also applies when there are connections, when lines connect to one another. And of course, this goes back to the musicians just being aware of with whom they connect, and drawing their attention to that. so that they can have a target or a goal. But just in general, the way that we approach silence and the way that we embrace silence, I'm thinking of Brahms especially. I'm working with one of my students right now on Brahms' First Symphony, and it is such a critical part of his composition. It's such an important technique for him and a part of his music. So I think we need to think more about that.
I just had a question that I just thought of. So it wasn't on our list of things I sent to you, but I don't think it should be too difficult.
It's okay.
So if you just hypothetically could add one class about anything to your students' program, what would you add if you had one more class worth of time with them? Or maybe not you, but you know, if they had to go take any other class, what would you add to their curriculum?
Yeah, I suppose it would be ear training. You know, we don't have a formal class in our degree programs. I know some do, but if I could somehow knit into that ear training and aural training, how to listen to an orchestra, you know, whether it be through recordings or, and I do this often, you know, in the course of our seminar class or whenever my students are in front of an ensemble, where we'll stop and I'll try to direct their ears a little bit, you know, if you'll listen to this, because it's so interesting how musicians can innately sense where it is you're listening. Mm-hmm. Even if you're not looking directly there, the way that we connect to the ensemble either helps to focus their listening in a good way or it doesn't. And it either connects us to the group or it doesn't. I do believe that the more we move, generally speaking, the less we hear.
Okay.
So, Luke, back to your question about, you know, training and all that. I think we should be changing the flow of energy more from output to input, you know, while we output, and creating a better ratio of listening to movement. Because just in general, the more physical we are, the less we hear. One of the ways that I train conductors or teach conducting or talk about how to better facilitate our groups playing together is just to not conduct, you know, because we've all experienced what I call podium deafness to one degree or another. You know, we stand over in the corner and we think, well, why can't that idiot hear that? And then when we get up there on the podium and we're tasked with leading the group and moving and all that, then we realize just how difficult it is. So again, knowing where to listen, knowing how to listen, knowing how to connect. And on that same, along this, that same line of thinking, I think precision in ensembles is just like we have to teach the group where to listen. We as conductors have to know where to listen. I'm talking to my students constantly about, well, listening on at least two different levels. One is an ensemble pulse related level, and then another might be a musical nuance shaping direction architectural sort of level, you know. But unless we stay connected with that pulse in the orchestra, regardless of how we're shaping or emoting or inspiring, it's going to make it either easier for the group to play together or more difficult for them.
Yeah. Is there ever a time where you would want to make it more difficult for them on purpose?
I can't imagine what that would be. I mean, I think our whole, like I'm back to the very first thing I said, I think our whole task is to facilitate the group, you know, make their job easier. But I often put it in the terms, you know, they've got their own problems, you know, don't make them deal with their problems and yours, you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the way a lot of conductors move in a really helter-skelter way, or by stopping the pulse or stopping the beat or slashing movements here or there, the musicians have to process that. Mm-hmm. And in a nanosecond, they have to decide, okay, should I try to deal with that or not? You know? And so we're constantly causing little micro crises like that, I think, in our conducting. And so the more we can move in a way that's connected to the sound, I'm constantly talking about staying inside the sound of the group, staying on the string, you know, so to speak, so that we are less likely to cause those problems. And it's more likely that our conducting is horizontally based and in the right color and in the right pulse.
Yeah. So one thing I really loved about the workshop that I did at Boulder a couple years ago was getting to play in the orchestra. I got so much from actually playing in the orchestra. And there's one point that I mentioned and think of a lot was it was the Tchaikovsky Serenade, the slow movement. Mm-hmm. And you know, most of the conductors, you know, you go up the thing and then you come down the thing, and they would just kind of release the end, and that felt really natural. And then there was one conductor who, when they got to the end of the phrase, instead of kind of like releasing, they just like stop. Mm-hmm. And my bow, like, and
right.
Like I could feel it in my body. And it was such a revealing moment. So I definitely encourage everybody to go to the workshop and play in the group if you can, just so you can feel something like that.
No, absolutely. I mean, many of my students over the years have been native string players. Mm-hmm. And so inevitably, if they're having a problem with their conducting, or it's not connecting, or it's not, you know, horizontal or whatever, I'll just say, how would you bow that?
Yeah.
And inevitably, they do something that's really elegant and really connected to conducting, you know? And so, yeah. Okay, do that, you
know? That.
It's just not so hard. I mean, and that's one of the beauties, I think, about orchestral conducting and working with strings is that it informs us in that way. It's a very horizontal movement, or, you know, in most cases, at least we think of it that way. And music is 95% horizontal, you know,
yeah.
with some few exceptions. And so staying in the sound, staying on the string, you know, moving into the silence, staying connected with the string players, all of these things are directly related.
So what do lessons with your conducting students look like? What's the format of those?
Well, we meet our seminar class with string quintet and piano meets once a week. So we have time to work through a lot of repertoire that's not in the ongoing curriculum of the orchestras or what it is that they're doing. Sometimes they'll bring, if they have an audition or if they have a performance coming up, sometimes they'll bring that to the seminar class and we'll work on that with them. But as far as, and we also have at least an hour long private lesson each week. And you know, right now we're at home in quarantine. And so those are all over Zoom,
yeah.
Which has actually been quite rewarding. I've loved that time. And that's one way that this current situation hasn't impacted my teaching so much, is that we can still talk about, you know, score studying. We can talk about the score. We can even go on the screen and share a score on the screen. But that's one, we'll maybe do video from the seminar class or the work they're doing in front of one of the existing ensembles, so we can look at it, talk about the conducting. You know, sometimes it's about resumes. Sometimes it's about job applications. Sometimes it's about degree progress. And, you know, advising. So, and sometimes it's just, how can I help you? You know, so it really varies a lot.
So what are some of the challenges that you've come across, you know, doing Zoom as a lesson? Do you find anything is like more challenging or maybe even easier than a normal lesson?
Well, I don't know. For me, it's been interesting because it's almost more focused, you know, in a way, because you're doing your best to stay connected with them. You're doing your best to, you know, look at the camera, create eye contact, however that's possible, you know, through Zoom. So for me, and maybe it's just the fact that I'm right now not able to be in front of an orchestra, that I cherish that time, that teaching time and sharing, talking about music, maybe even more than, you know, I did when I took it for granted. But, you know, there aren't a lot of limitations. Like I said, you can even share, you know, you can share your screen, you can share a video, we can have a PDF up there on the screen that we can talk about it. I can hold the score up to the camera if I need to, or we can just say, hey, look at measure 37. Isn't that cool how this harmonic progression leads into this, you know, this special moment. So really, mm-hmm. I haven't found it to be limiting with regard to that. Now, movement and demonstrating on the camera and that sort of thing obviously is a bit more difficult, but other than that, it's been surprisingly easy.
So since yeah. you are finishing out the semester on Zoom. How are you suggesting to your students to practice their conducting since they won't be able to actually be in front of an ensemble?
Yeah, you know, for me, practicing conducting is it's difficult, you know, without an ensemble anyway, you know, without being in front of an ensemble. So if we had the seminar class, there'd be that, you know, time each week, and then the ongoing work, they conduct the campus orchestra on a weekly basis. So they don't have access to that. So I think it's more just a matter of contemplation, score study. My idea of score study as it connects to gesture is to be as organic about it as you can, you know, and not like, I think I'll try this really cool move here, but it's okay. How do I sing this line? How does this two note shape seem to me? What is the, you know, architecture of this section? And then as we're sitting with the score in our lap, I think singing is the closest thing to our musical intuition. So singing through a passage and then finding ourselves, well, how did I move to that? You know, it's really interesting. I'm sure you both observed this in conducting workshops where you'll ask somebody to sing a passage and they'll just naturally move with the most beautiful, elegant, you know, thing, gesture. And so I think if it's internally driven conducting and musical gesture, then I think it's going to tend to be more organic, more elegant, and more informative. So I guess we're relegated to just contemplating music. I'm encouraging them to watch. I mean, you know, the Berlin Philharmonic website is now free to everybody. There's so many online, resources where we can compare four or five different performances of the Shostakovich symphony and, well, wonder why he or she did that. Oh, that's cool. But that's a cool bowing, yeah. You know? And so just continuing to inform ourselves and growing as musicians.
I think that's the work that's always going to be really valuable, but that we rarely take the time because we usually don't have the time.
No, I think you're right. Yeah. And just finding ways to grow as a musician. I know we're all busy in our own way, and I find myself juggling two or three or four programs at the same time with different groups and mm-hmm. just having the time to contemplate and to think, you know, to stretch out is difficult. And so this time has allowed us at least the luxury of a bit more of that. And I'm trying to I've actually thought recently, how can I maintain that when things, you know, get back to a normal rush and normal pace? How can I preserve that for myself and for my own personal growth?
What did you?
I decided to try, you know.
yeah.
So.
Yeah, and I think that's a big thing for conductors that are in school, that are leaving school, because suddenly you don't have somebody checking up on you every week. And I know I've been out of school for almost 2 years now, and I know for me, not having regular lessons. You know, there was a transition period for a little bit where I let all my bad habits mm-hmm. come back in until I did a workshop, and then I remembered, oh, that's right, I was working on these.
Right. You know, I think that's harkening back to Gustav Meyer. I think that's one of the beauties about sort of this framework of ideas, even though it wasn't really formally structured in any way, but it allowed you to teach yourself, to become your own teacher. Mm-hmm. Another thing he used to always say is it's always the conductor's fault. And to a certain degree, that's true. I mean, once the group has certain technical mastery, if it's not together, most likely it's something that the conductor is doing or not doing that's causing the problem. And so he taught his students and those of us that observed him how to self-assess in that way. Well, I wonder what about that upbeat was not helpful because it's not together, you know, or I wonder why this transition is not working or why this release seems really funky. So I think having just that basic code of skills or level of awareness about how our gesture affects the group, I think is really helpful. It's another interesting aspect of Gunther Schuller's discussion about hearing and listening is that not only do we have to hear what the group is doing, but we have to hear how our gesture is affecting what the group is doing. It's important to remember that as well.
Yeah, the complete conductor was was a really important book for me early on. I, you know, back when I had time, I sat down with, you know, almost every recording of Beethoven 5 that I could and followed through with his like analysis. And that just like opened up my ears so much when I was younger. And I always encourage people to take, just set aside a couple hours and practice listening.
Yeah. And that, you know, that section, those two or three pages on listening, I found is what I refer to most often, unless I'm conducting one of those works that he analyzes in detail. Mm-hmm. And that, as you mentioned, can be really informative. But yeah, it's a really helpful thing to focus our listening. I remember my colleague Don Schleicher and I, when we were colleagues at Michigan, we talked, even this was well before that list of seven different hearings or whatever it had even been published. But we used to talk about our rehearsals and sort of debriefing ourselves on what happened in the rehearsal. And we realized that if we had dealt a little bit with intonation, and we dealt a little bit with pulse and rhythm, and we dealt a little bit with, you know, color, and we dealt some with direction and shape, then that was a pretty good rehearsal. So trying to be less, less monochromatic, for lack of a better term, in our rehearsals, in our listening, we are all a product of our own experiences, and we all have strengths and weaknesses. So we are all innately better at hearing on different levels for different things. And so it's a matter, back to this idea of how can we grow, if intonation and pitch is your weakness, then as you're listening to recordings and you're listening to your in the rehearsal, make that a top priority, because chances are you're going to notice the pulse and rhythm stuff, you know. And for me, that was very true early in my career. I remember at one of my associates sitting in the back of rehearsal, and I'd walk out, you know, all proud. Well, I think that was a pretty good rehearsal, don't you? And he said, yeah, it was good. Might want to check the intonation in the alto saxophones and measure letter A. And wow, the flutes are about 30 cents sharp on that F sharp, you know, and things that I had not even heard, much less was aware of or prepared to deal with. So that really was important in my development, because he was bringing something that was a real strength of his to the way that he heard the ensemble. And then I tried to adopt that. And so we all have strengths and weaknesses. We need to assess what those are as musicians. And then we need to try to address the stuff that we can't do as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Pitch has always been a weak spot of mine, because I'll be like assisting a concert, and then the conductor will say like, oh, the trombones are sharp. I didn't hear that. I guess I'll listen for it now.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah. What's some advice that you would give to all like early career students? And then what's some advice that you wish you would have gotten when you were younger?
I think the best advice I can give people with regard to career is to just don't try to overplan. You know, I mean, I think the best plan is to just continue to grow as much as you can as a musician and as a conductor, and then be flexible. Life is it's a series of doors that open to us, and we're either ready and we have the skills to step through that and onto the next thing, or we're not. So trying to be as prepared as we can, trying to grow as much as we can as musicians, conductors, communicators, teachers, educators, so that when those opportunities present themselves, we're prepared to take them. I think it was John Lennon who said that life is what happens when you're busy making plans. And so our career is what happens when we're busy planning our career, you know. So I think just being patient, growing, and then being ready to take advantage of opportunities when they present themselves, I think is the best advice I can offer. And just continuing to become the best musician you can on your instrument. We don't learn our musicianship on the podium. I mean, we can continue to grow, but our initial base foundation of musicianship, we learn through our instrument and through performance and shared performance. So I think that's an important thing to keep in mind.
Yeah, absolutely.
Do you still perform your instrument as well?
I don't. but as I intimated earlier, and as I'm sure, you know, a lot of my colleagues, basically with the leadership of three different ensembles and a major university program, it's hard to maintain that. the current situation may afford me the opportunity. I keep threatening to get my guitar out of the of the closet and getting reacquainted a little bit there. But that's one of the difficult things about being a conductor, and a conductor principally, you know, that's not a regular performer, is that's really kind of our only outlet. So, but certainly everything that I did as a younger musician and as an applied teacher, actually, at the university level, has informed who I am now as a jazz musician. I feel, and especially as a rhythm player, I feel like that really helped to inform my sense of time and pulse, and my level of awareness and communication, because in jazz, it's critical. You're either aware or you're not, you know. I'll never forget playing a gig once when I was quite young, and I was so absorbed in what I was doing, and looked up, and I was about 9 measures into what had been given to me as a solo, you know, but I missed the cue, you know. And so back to that idea of awareness, you know. But I think that really informed who I am as a musician, and certainly every experience we have does. And then what's true as a result is every group is a reflection of the expectations of its conductor. We've either developed, you know, a high level of expectation, a high level of musicianship, a high standard of performance and collaboration, or we haven't. We're somewhere on that spectrum. And no group is going to rise, very few groups, except professional level groups, are going to rise above the level of expectation of the person in front of them. And so we just have to continue to grow. I know I'm sort of paranoid about, you know, trying to make sure that I'm prepared, trying to make sure that I'm growing, trying to make sure that I'm the best musician I can be, because I don't want to be exposed as a fraud, you know. I think we all have that fear. And whenever I've had opportunities to, you know, like step in front of the Colorado Symphony or whatever, that paranoia becomes even stronger, you know, because you want to be able to meet the moment and to be able to share and collaborate with really high level musicians. And so we should all continue to challenge ourselves, no matter what level of group we're conducting.
My teacher, and I guess Jeremy learned from him as well, his last year there at MSU, but Dr. Keltz always used to say a phrase, and I cannot remember what it was, but it was kind of in the same vein of like, you know, preparation is the most important thing, because if you're not prepared, there's no quicker way that you'll be exposed as a fraud than getting up in front of an orchestra unprepared, because the orchestra will know.
That's right.
And ever since he told, like, you know, we had that discussion in seminar,
right?
It's like always in the back of my head of like, okay, are you prepared enough? Like, if you get in front of this orchestra today, will you be a fraud?
Right. No, exactly.
And, you know, yeah, it's scary to think about, but it's very motivating to always, you know, be on your stuff, because, you know, as a conductor, you are a leader, and how can you ask your orchestra to prepare something that you can't even prepare yourself?
That's right. And it's interesting. It's interesting how that whatever aspect of this work you didn't prepare as well, or whatever foreign term you failed to look up, or whatever, you know, interesting thing about this work, that's that without fail, it comes up in a course of a rehearsal and exposes us, you know, for our lack of preparation. So, you know, I often talk about score study as a process of internalization, trying to internalize the score to the point where it more organically is just part of us, rather than just a collection of decisions or, you know, a set of markings on the page, but it becomes something that's more organically part of us. I've often said, I wish you could take a pill for your first time with a piece so you could start on your second, because we all know about the just exponential difference or growth there is between the first and second time with a piece. And then if we have the luxury of doing it multiple times, then that level of familiarity is what we're all aspiring for in every work that we conduct. So that first time with a piece, with a work, it's more laborious. It's more almost academic, if that's the right term, rather than something that's organic and flows from us. So striving to get to that point is what the greatest challenge that we have, I think.
Yeah. I think on that first time, a lot of a lot of that first time is becoming familiar with the technical aspects of the piece as well.
Sure. Oh, of course. Yeah, you have everything. You're having to think on so many different levels. You know, Bob Reynolds used to say, if you're thinking while you're conducting, you're in trouble, you know, and that's true. There's this book called Thinking Fast and Slow by Kahneman, which is really an interesting premise to me, and that there are two systems of thinking. You know, there's the 2 + 2 = 4 level of thinking, where we're not really having to think about it. And then there's the 24 × 17 level of thinking, where we have to stop and process and actually cognate. And so trying to get to the point in rehearsal where our technical mastery of the technique, our knowledge of the score, our awareness is enhanced by all that, to the point where we don't have to think on that more sophisticated or more challenging level.
See, I'm someone who's kind of a bit of a control freak sometimes. And so like, I'll like have my score in front of me and I'll be conducting, and then I'll stop for a moment just to think about one thing in the middle of it, and it'll just completely throw me off.
Derail you. Yeah. That's exactly right. That's what Bob meant when he said, if you start thinking when you're on the podium, you're in trouble. Right. So, but in truth, we are thinking on so many levels. I mean, it's got to be the most complex cognitive activity, or among those that there is, because, you know, you're consulting this aural model in your head. You're comparing what you're hearing against that. You're giving out information. You're giving specific cues and instruction. And then you're thinking, diagnosing the problem, and then you're prescribing a solution. And then you're wondering, I wonder if the principal viola is just having a bad hair day, or if they hate me, you know? And so, so all these things are going on, at the same time. And then when we stop, you know, we have to quickly and concisely address the issues and go on. So it's a wonder, really, how complex and sophisticated what we do when we're on the podium is from a cognitive standpoint. So the more roadblocks we can take out of the way, the more stumbling blocks we can get out of the way, the more effective we're going to be. There were just a couple of interesting things. I was fortunate enough to go to Berlin a year and a half or so ago. And Fergus McWilliam is a longtime horn player in the group. I think he was hired by Carrion and has been there through Cliver and Rattle and now into the press. So he's seen it all, you know. Yeah. The first time I met him was a few years before that. We were just there, and I through a mutual friend had connected with him, and he was so generous with his time, and we connected immediately because, you know, I was really evangelistic about chamber music and making large ensembles about chamber music, and that may be the best example of it, you know, among the major orchestras of the world and how they interact. And so that really resonated with both of us. But one of the things that he said in my most recent trip there was, you know, we don't follow the conductor. We pay attention to them, but we don't follow them, you know.
Yeah.
And that's part of this whole chamber music aspect of music making in our groups, where we trust them to take care of a lot of things, and then they pay attention to what it is that's helpful or informative, you know, to them. And he also related a story about Carlos Kleiber being on the podium. And he said I forget what the work was. I wish I could remember. It's in my notes somewhere. But it was a difficult tune to start. And Kleiber just organically said, you know, I just imagine what Duke Ellington, how he would start this from the piano. And he moved, and the whole orchestra just, bam, right in with the best precision they'd ever had, you know. So even Carlos Kleiber, you know, thought in terms of Duke Ellington and jazz and whatever would best inform, you know, the best way to connect with the orchestra.
Yeah.
You know, aside from a couple of amusing anecdotes about failure, I think that's most of what I was prepared to cover. Yeah.
Huh. Well, I would love to hear some amusing anecdotes about failure.
Well, you know, two things. One, as I mentioned earlier in my life, I was, it's not so amusing actually, but it's about survival. I was the director of the Michigan Marching Band, and I was this outsider coming from Texas who'd had no history with the group, and so the first year or two were quite difficult. In fact, recently the Michigan Daily, which is the student newspaper of the University of Michigan, put all their archives online, so I was able to go back and look at some of the articles that were written, you know, about me and my work, and it was incredibly painful at the time, you know, and even a former director called for my resignation in the student newspaper, you know. So there were very challenging things just on a personal level about that. But, you know, after that first year, the second year was better. After that second year, the third year was better. And so as teachers, you learn that first years are always going to be first years, you know, but that things get better after that. Another amusing story that I've sadly now committed to, something I've done twice, which is, you know, the sign of insanity or stupidity, one of the two. But Gustav Meyer pioneered these Halloween concerts. He brought those to the University of Michigan. And so the orchestra was in costume, and the conductors would come out in costume, something loosely or directly related to the repertoire. And so he wanted me to conduct O Lois movement from Michael Doherty's Metropolis Symphony. And he wanted me to come out as Clark Kent. And then in the middle of a piece where there's this dueling flexitone sort of moment, he wanted me to jump into a phone booth, come out as Superman, and then conduct the rest of the piece as Superman, right? So, yeah. So rented a costume. Gustav Meyer in his garage took a refrigerator box and made a phone booth out of it. And so I came out as Clark Kent, got started. Everything is going pretty well. I'd had this costume change down to like 12 seconds. So they throw the phone booth up by the podium. I jump in, rip off the suit, had the skin tight Superman suit on the, you know, underneath. And all I had to do was grab the cape and clasp it, jump out and go. Well, I grabbed the cape, tried to clasp it, and the clasp broke. So I was there in front of over 2,000 people with the choice. Okay, do I crash the orchestra or do I drop this cape and expose the skin-tight suit here, you know, in front of 2,000 people? So I took one for the team and dropped the cape, you know. Yeah. And then several years later, I replicated this idea when I was on the faculty at Texas Tech as a scholarship fundraiser, except this time the work was Jupiter from the Planets, and I went out and bought a big rubber mask, oversized brain kind of thing, and wandered out on stage trying to be in character and greeted the concertmaster like I was an alien from Jupiter, you know. And for some stupid reason, I turned to the podium, and instead of just stepping up on what was a rather high podium, probably 18 inches or so, I decided to jump up. Well, I couldn't see anything except out of these two little nose holes that were there to breathe because the bug eyes had fogged over. I try to jump up, I misjudge it, fall, and I